This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are talking about parenting, one of those priceless but somehow thankless jobs. In the second half of today's show, we learn about a former spy and how that influenced her parenting. But we are going to start today with this. Imagine raising 10 kids during the Depression. Martin and Asta Odnes did that in Van Hook, North Dakota, after emigrating from Norway. Granddaughter Barb Solberg of Minot traced the family's agonizing decision to send three children back to Norway in hopes of a better life, only to have World War II break out. In a conversation that first aired in 2022, we learn about the book, What We Leave Behind. Barb, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with what we would call the pull quote. On the cover of the book, it says, Asta pressed the photo to her heart, paused, and then put an X over the heads of three of her daughters. And Barb, this is the story of your grandparents, Martin and Asta, coming to the United States in 1913, leaving at the time some poor circumstances that were happening in Norway in search of a better life, as so many people were doing at that time period. But you start the book, and the cover of the book is all of these faces and then the three X's over three of these tiny little faces. So start with who Asta and Martin are and this impossible choice that they have to come to.
Martin and Asta are my grandparents, and I never knew them. I understand that I saw my grandfather once, but these were grandparents I never knew. And they had actually 10 girls and one boy. And so the picture you see on the front cover is of the family of children in 1932. And they're all girls on there except one boy who was right in the middle, because they had all daughters except one son. And what happened was their family in Norway had wanted them to come home and visit. And of course, they couldn't afford to do that. They had several children and, you know, farming wasn't going so well during the Dust Bowl. But my grandfather had a wealthy cousin in Norway, and she was single, and they thought it would be a good idea, the cousin did and the other family members in Norway, if they would just send a few of their girls over. And so the relatives in Norway actually paid for the trip, and the idea was that they would send three girls for 2 years. And so the X's on the front on the picture, my mother had told me this story about, you know, when the girls had gone over. But in 1975, when I was in Norway, my grandmother's youngest sister, Elsie, who never met her sister, came running out of her house and brought this picture with her to show me. And this is the picture she showed me, the X's over the heads. And she told me, and someone interpreted it for her, that this was the picture that my grandparents sent so that the girls would be recognized when they got off the boat in Oslo. And I was just overwhelmed by that picture. And, you know, I was meeting my aunts for the first time. So if you look at the picture on the very back of the book, those were two of the girls that are on the front cover. Mm-hmm. And here they are as adults living in Norway, and they're, you know, kind of telling me some of the family stories. And so I was really captured by that picture, and really wanted to know more. So, you know, 40 years later, that was 1975, 40 years later in, you know, 2015, I was in Norway and I was visiting with my first cousins. And the middle girl, Boya, before she died, sat down and wrote her story, 35 pages in Norwegian, about what had happened in her life. And this was part of the family story that nobody had.
Yeah.
And my cousin she said, well, I have my mother's story, and I brought it. And so she took it out. We were sitting in the family big house in Odnes, Norway, and she brought it out and started to translate it. And I'm just very hurriedly trying to write this down. Mm-hmm. And then Oh, just a minute, she said. I think my daughter will translate it for you. So she did, and I think it was probably about a year later that I got this email with 16 pages of Boya's story told, and it told us what was happening to the girls when they were in Norway, and, you know, they didn't get home after 2 years because the oldest one got married, and the two little ones were left without a way to get home. So I was real captivated by what I had learned about my aunt's life, their lives when they were in Norway. And somehow the family needed to know that story.
Yeah. We've just touched on this idea that there are three daughters sent back to Norway in these really desperate economic times. But let's stress here that Clara is just barely 18, and she is in charge of Borghild, who later goes by Boya, and then Eleanor. Boya at the time is 8, and Eleanor is 4. I mean, it feels an impossible choice to make between, do I continue to struggle every day to feed these children, or do I continue to struggle with not seeing them?
You know, and I think they probably felt like this was going to be good for the girls. You know, for 2 years, they would go meet the family in Norway, and the cousin there, you know, was a wealthy woman, and my mother always said that they thought they were going to be going, you know, to dance lessons, and they would be going to Switzerland, and everybody at home thought they were having a great life in Norway without realizing what really was happening there. And so it was, you know, it had a lot of tragedy to it. And then the poor little ones, you know, were just kind of left because their sister got married. And they just had to bounce around with whatever the cousin was doing, who was really not a real good surrogate mother. And just, you know, for part of that story, she ended up getting married. The cousin did, and she married a Quisling, who was a Nazi sympathizer. And that really turned, you know, a lot of things upside down for the girls.
Yes. there is a section in the book where, you know, Boya really starts to sort of realize that there's something going on with this surrogate stepfather. You know, she's recognizing the symbol on the clothing, and she's recognizing that he's going to these meetings and that they don't talk about what was happening in these meetings. And in your last answer, Barb, you use the phrase, you know, that you thought that they'd be going to dance lessons, and then they were, and it was the first time in the lives of these girls that they ever had brand new clothing and like a plethora of toys. There was a material wealth that came with this move to Norway. But then you said, what was really happening? And this 2 years turned into...
It was the rest of their lives, actually.
Yeah.
They didn't come back. The whole family got together in 1947. It was after the war, and, you know, the girls were going to come back. Eleanor was the four-year-old when she left, and she just wanted to come and meet her family. She really didn't know them. A four-year-old doesn't remember what things were like. And what I found interesting was Eleanor didn't stop at the home place in Van Hook. The parents had moved out to Seattle. But when Boya and her husband came back, they did. They stopped in Minneapolis, and then they stopped at my parents in Minot, and then they went down to Van Hook because Boya could remember where, you know, where she had been for those first 8 years and wanted to see it. So Eleanor's whole life wasn't attached to Van Hook, and so she was meeting, you know, a new family. How was she going to do this? It was just, you know, there was a lot of joy and a lot of sorrow in writing it, actually.
Yeah, you talk about near the end of the book that Asta and Martin had, you know, this 10 children, and there was only one time in their entire lives where all of the children were together, and they were all fully adults at this point. Eleanor had siblings who had a sibling who was born after she had already left for Norway, and she never met that sibling until she was an adult. And this really touching story about how Eleanor was naming her toys after her siblings in an attempt to remember them. And the way that she mourns later on, there's a measles outbreak And it takes the lives of one of the youngest of the siblings. And Eleanor every day has a funeral in her toys to grieve a person she's never, ever going to meet. Barb, how did you put yourself in this mindset? I mean, I know that you had Boya's journals from this time, but to really even start to imagine the depth of feeling that these young women and children were feeling.
I don't know. I just remember, you know, I was committed to write every day from 1 to 4. And some days, you know, when I had to get inside their head, it was very emotional. I mean, I have to admit, I did a lot of crying, you know, to become what life must have been like for them. And I was in a writing incubator in Little Mole Writers that Humanities North Dakota had. And Deb Marquardt, the instructor, told me, she said, you know, when you write fiction, it's like playing dolls. You have to give the dolls names, and you have to dress the dolls, and you have to have the dolls have friends. And I think that really was powerful for me, because I had to consider these two girls especially sort of like dolls. I have to give them a life. I have to give them feelings. I have to color their world some way, and the color wasn't always bright.
I want to talk, too, about another major theme that develops in the book, because in addition to the economic hardship of the 30s, then we start to lead into World War II. And so often we think of World War II, and you really just think about Germany, you think about Japan, you think about the attack on Pearl Harbor, you think about the invasion of Poland, you think about D-Day. We don't really think, at least I don't, that much about what was happening in Norway. But Norway was occupied at the time, and you have this family dynamic here of the surrogate stepfather of the three girls ending up being a Nazi sympathizer, and then Clara and Boya go on to marry people who are part of the Norwegian resistance, and they are fighting the Nazis. How much of the story of Nazi-occupied Norway did you know going into writing this book?
I did not know very much at all. I had to spend quite a bit of time, you know, doing research on that. But I had always thought, you know, when my mother started telling me some of the story, how strange this was, that here they were living with a Quisling, a Nazi sympathizer. The Clara's husband was sending messages to England downstairs in the potato bin or the coal bin, whatever it was, and, you know, doing undercover work. That we had just so many variables that, you know, the water was murky. So it was really fun for me to kind of tease out exactly what was going on. And I did quite a bit of reading, and I also watched an awful lot of YouTube about World War II and about Norway. And then to be able to tie it to the family was easy, because I knew that they were part of that. And then a relative had posted a picture to Facebook, which was his dad or his grandfather, who had been part of the resistance. I was really captivated to keep finding more.
Boya was sent to a concentration camp.
She had spent some time at Grini. We didn't know how long. As I was doing research on Grini online, here I found another woman's story about when she had been at Grini. And her name was Anna. And when I did the time sequence on when my aunt was there and when Anna was there, it was the same time. So some of what Anna had written about in her diary that I found online was, I incorporated part of that into the story, because it told me more about what was going on when my aunt was there. And then the interesting thing was when my aunt had written that Turboven, the head of the Nazi party in Norway, had made it possible for Boya to be released.
Right.
Then I really needed to know more, not only about Quisling, but also about Turboven and and how that all happened.
Well, yeah, these ideas of loyalty and justice and how we can be kind of divided as people to end up in a concentration camp and then be rescued by a member of a Nazi sympathizing party because of some family connections, but also then to still remain true to like Boya's personal ethics of not at all being attached to a Nazi sympathizing party. What kinds of thoughts did you start to have as you examine this idea of loyalty? For starters, she's loyal to two countries, the United States and Norway. She's loyal to the surrogate family that adopted her, but she's also loyal to these personal ethics that don't align with the surrogate family and these ideas of morality and loyalty and justice and how complicated they can all be in a war.
Right. I think one of the saving factors for her was not only did she have to be strong, but she was young. Mm. You know, she didn't have too many choices and had to be strong even after her sister got married. And, you know, being in the family with the Quisling and the cousin and then her younger sister, and the loyalties were really pulled, but I think she was one tough broad.
Is there any other kind of woman?
Oh, I know. And that at such a young age, you know, 14, 15, and 16, to become strong relatively independently who was helping her be strong? She had to be strong by herself. And I think she knew that and had to step out on her own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't stay back to take care of Eleanor, but she still, you know, harbored her in her heart and in her thoughts and kept putting one foot forward, never really knowing what was next. Everybody in the family had good intentions. You know, nobody had bad intentions. It's just every intention seemed to get twisted and it didn't turn out right. I think that happened to a lot of homesteading families and a lot of families with family in the war. It's a huge story. It was too big not to try to put the pieces together.
Right.
And tell it. And then to sit back and say, oh my gosh, you know, this is my family.
Mm-hmm. It was weird to me that it feels big to me and it's not my family. But in reading this book, it really did feel like I had a connection to this. And I'm curious, Barb, as you talk about, you know, Boya in particular being a strong woman,
mm-hmm.
I want to pull on this thread of how much this story turns into a woman's story. And we know so much about the homesteading era of this country's history, but so often it is told by the men who were doing this backbreaking work of, you know, building the homes and proving up the homesteading land and the soldiers who were going off to war and they were standing in breadlines during the Depression. And it was an incredibly complicated time to be alive. But we don't hear as many stories as told from a woman's perspective. And of course, Martin and Asta, you know, they have 11 children, 10 of whom survive into adulthood, most of whom, as you mentioned, are women. So there is just a numbers game here where they have the advantage of it being a woman's story. But when you started writing the book, was it intentional that this was going to be about the dedication and intelligence and just sort of emotional strength that a woman brings to this kind of story? Or did it happen almost by accident?
You know, I would say it happened by accident. And I think when it started to become a woman's story was when I realized two different points. When Asta and Martin were going to her brother in Rugby, it kind of became her story. And then when they ended up in Barton and Martin had to get on the train and go back to the homestead, and there she was, 18, and giving birth to their first child while Martin was on the train.
Yeah.
And she was in Barton, and I thought, you know, this woman was really put into a situation where she had to be strong. She was by herself, and then it became, who were her friends when she got to Van Hook? And it became a woman's story then, as the women gathered and shared what was going on in their lives. And I think, being a woman myself, it made it easier than telling about, you know, what it was like to plow the South 40, you know. But it was a woman's story at that point, and it just kind of continued. And then Boya, technically, you know, kind of wrote her own story with those pages that she had written before. I think when you go to an art exhibit and you see a painting, often you'll see the artist's pencil sketch, and then you see what happened afterwards with the colorful pieces that were put on there. And that's what it kind of became for me, that, you know, there was a pencil sketch out there, and then I had to color it for who was going to stand out and what were these people going to be like in my imagination.
Now, none of the people who are written about in the book are still alive today, but you are in touch with some of the extended family. There are trips back and forth between the United States and Norway every 5 years. What has been the reaction among the rest of your family in keeping this story alive?
So 5 years ago, we were out in California, and there must have been 125 of us, and a lot of them from Norway came. And
wow.
I then had pulled together all of the research and also had what Boya had written. So I had put a book together with just the straight history, the documents and those kinds of things. And so I did a presentation at the family gathering. I think it was probably 3 hours one morning. I had put a PowerPoint together and told the rest of the family about the story with these documents. And then I had copies of the book there so that they could have the pencil sketch of the whole family story. And I have to say, quite honestly, there was a lot of crying that morning when we all realized, you know, what our grandparents and aunts had gone through. And an interesting piece, kind of in this same light, is I sent 3 copies of the book to cousins in Norway, and Eleanor's daughter, who has the home place now, sent me a message, and she said, "Thank you so much," she said, "for telling the story." She said, "I never knew Martin and Asta, and I wish you could write about the other sisters, because we don't know their stories either." Mm. So, you know, it was kind of putting the pieces together, but the pieces of the story I had were the pieces of Martin and Asta, and then what Boya had written, and then documents from when they had gotten together in Seattle. Mm. When I first was thinking about doing this was, decades ago. I don't know if you read The Thorn Birds.
No, I never have.
I liked the way that book was put together. Each chapter had, the title was the name of somebody different in the family, and then it was their part of the story, and I'd always thought that, you know, that would be a way I could put this book together. But as I started to do it, I realized it was not the story of all the sisters and the one brother. It was the story of Asta and the 3 girls.
That was Minot's Barb Solberg talking about her book, What We Leave Behind. That conversation first aired in May of 2022. Still to come on Main Street, from a CIA operative to a mom. That's after this.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and as we learned in the first half of today's show, with parenting comes very tough choices. Sometimes you can have a little bit of fun with that, especially if you used to be a CIA operative. In 2021, we spoke with Christina Hillsberg about her book, License to Parent, about how her training influences her parenting. Christina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your road to the CIA, because as you mention in the book, the movies get it all wrong.
That's right. You know, what you see in the James Bond films is not how it is at the actual CIA. I like to say that if you're pulling out a gun or you're chasing someone or, you know, they're chasing you, you've done something wrong. Espionage should be done in the shadows, right under the noses of foreign governments without them even realizing it's being done. So it's definitely a different look and than what you're used to. And I talk about that in the book. And, you know, License to Parent is part memoir and part parenting guide. So I share the story of how I joined the CIA, which was really more of a happy accident than any sort of careful planning. I studied linguistics and African languages in college, and I knew I wanted to do something in Africa. I was thinking I'd do the Peace Corps. I actually interviewed with the Peace Corps and the CIA during the same week and had very different experiences. And when I learned what I would be doing at the CIA, you know, writing and briefing U.S. policymakers on African politics and African leaders, I was really excited about that opportunity, especially because I could use my Swahili and Zulu skills. And so it was an easy choice for me, and I never looked back, and I had a fantastic career.
Why are Swahili and Zulu important to the CIA?
Well, the CIA is always looking for people with, you know, language capabilities so that we have a better understanding of what's going on in the world. And I always viewed my position as an analyst as an opportunity to, you know, educate people about a part of the world that they often don't know much about. And it was something that I was really passionate about. And so they're always looking for linguists in different areas so that they can get an understanding of politics in different regions and how that relates to the U.S. and, you know, bilateral relationships and, you know, implications for our country and our citizens. And so they're always looking for that. My husband was also recruited for his language capabilities. He speaks French, Danish, and Portuguese.
I have interviewed a lot of people, and I'm going to just say that you are the first one who has ever said, oh, yeah, and I was just really interested in Swahili and Zulu, you know, especially throwing in that you're a white person from the U.S. Why were you even drawn to this part of the world and these languages specifically?
I became interested in Africa in high school. I did a project on Somalia and became interested in African politics. And I also discovered that I had a knack for languages, but I wasn't really able to do much with that in high school. We start foreign language learning often very late in the U.S., although I do think that's changing. And I wasn't really able to progress like I wanted to, just simply based on how the high school courses were taught. And I knew I wanted to learn a language that wasn't Indo-European. I didn't want to study Spanish anymore. I didn't want to study Latin anymore. I wanted to do something more unique. And because I also have that interest in African politics, it only made sense. And so when I was looking at languages, I focused primarily on Swahili because it is so widely spoken on the continent. And it's an interesting language. It's a Bantu language. The structure is really fascinating. It also borrows a lot of vocabulary from Arabic in the coastal areas. And I loved the sound of it, the melodic structure and the culture behind it. And, you know, I just enjoyed every class I did. And so when there was an opportunity to have a career that I could use that, I think I had a lot of friends who were thinking, probably family too, like, what on earth are you going to do with this degree? Right. You know, like, and I ended up graduating early before my friends, just by nature of circumstances. And I was, you know, out working for the CIA when all of my friends were doing their senior year of college. And it was like, well, I guess that sort of really, you know, crazy degree worked out.
Yeah, work for the CIA, then get recruited into the private sector working for Amazon, and now I've written a book. I'd say you've put this degree to good use. In as much as there is such a thing as an average day working as an analyst for the CIA, what was that like?
Sure. So most days, I mean, no day is alike, but, you know, most days we would start with reviewing the traffic, the intelligence. We called it traffic, but it was the intelligence reports that came in overnight. So you'd get in and you'd review that, and then you would have a morning meeting with all of your teammates, and you would brief your management on the developments overnight and what that means going forward. And you would decide what pieces you're going to write. And so we were regularly writing for the President's Daily Brief book, which is a book of intelligence articles that the President and Cabinet get every day. And we would also be doing briefings and answering taskings. And so I would, some days I would be going down to National Security Council and briefing on Africa or the U.S. Department of State, or, you know, meetings with other agencies in the intelligence community, meetings with FBI. And so it could look a variety of ways. You know, of course, there were also some days where I was sitting and working on longer research papers. And there's lots of writing and lots of briefing as an analyst.
Yeah, you have something called bluff writing, bottom line up front. And yeah, I'm going to guess the leader of the free world has a lot to read in any given day, and you're looking at this intelligence, you've got to sum up something in just a couple of sentences. And it's not just who, what, where, why, when, it's why that matters. Is someone going to die?
That's right. You're having to distill a lot of information. You know, you synthesize it first. You have to glean what's important, and you have to get that bottom line up front. And that's a structure of writing that I discuss in the book, because we want to teach that to our kids. A lot of people don't realize that one of a spy's most prized traits is the ability to write well. Even on the operations side, they do a fair bit of writing up their intelligence reports, writing up cables after their meetings. You know, but on the analytics side, we, you know, writing and briefing is our bread and butter. And we want our kids to learn these skills because they're transferable to all careers. And the earlier our kids can learn how to write and, you know, communicate well, have these verbal presentation skills, that is going to set them up for so much success in life.
Yeah, I was surprised to see a chapter from a CIA analyst and spy in a book about how to use CIA techniques to raise resourceful kids. And then you have this chapter on writing. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
You automatically think of those physical skills, uh-huh, like how to spot and avoid danger and being prepared for emergencies. But like you don't necessarily think about, well, you know, James Bond was a savvy communicator. What went into that? You know, there is writing that we talk about, you know, communication in the book in terms of building rapport with others. And one of the ways that we learn that at the CIA is through a concept called you, me, same, same. And that consists of, you know, building rapport with someone through common interests. And in order to have common interests, you need to be a well-rounded individual. And so we talk about that in the book in ways that we expose our kids to lots of different topics and activities from a young age so that they're able to pull from this repertoire to make and build connections with people throughout their lives.
This you, me, same, same. And I'm wondering, before we even get into more parenting advice that you have, you had to become a parent. You had to meet this guy, Ryan. And I'm just wondering, as you start dating someone, you are trained in the CIA. He is trained in with the CIA. Knowing what you knew about how CIA analysts and spies build rapport for the sole purpose of extracting information, how do you establish intimacy if you're kind of thinking, wait, is he using you, me, same, same? Am I using you, me, same, same?
Well, it's funny because when it's done well, you won't recognize it. Mm. And I will say that one of the things about Ryan is that he was such a fantastic operations officer because he built relationships with people in a genuine way. He wasn't, you know, putting it on. He wasn't pretending to be interested in something he wasn't. Although I joke in the book that, like, I told him, oh, yeah, you know, you can teach me how to ski. And to this day, this still hasn't happened. And he gives me such a hard time about it. But I'm happy to report that we just bought my first pair of skis at the end of the ski season. And so I'm up to bat next winter. So I'm having to make good on that promise. So I was not genuine. I just said, oh, yeah, sure, you could teach me. So I'm having to deliver on that. But Ryan, on the other hand, you know, he genuinely has all of these interests. He's someone who speaks multiple languages. He, you know, he bakes, he cooks, he can talk about medieval knives. You know, he's, you know, very athletic and coordinated and all these different things. And so when someone does it like that, it's not identifiable as them, you know, we call it using their trade craft. There were certainly people I encountered when dating at the CIA who tried to use their trade craft in a not so savvy way, and then it just crashes and burns, right? But it's funny because in the book I do talk about when I introduce the idea of persuasion and teaching our kids how to be persuasive, I kind of step back and say, wait a minute, how many times has Ryan used this on me? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until sitting down and writing that chapter that I was able to put pieces together from the past almost 10 years and realize, oh my goodness.
We're visiting with Christina Hillsberg. She is the author of License to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. Christina, when you first met Ryan, he was a divorced dad already. So not only are you entering a relationship with this high-profile kind of a position, high-adrenaline kind of position, but you are just an automatic stepmom into what is a very different style of parenting than most. Describe how Ryan interacts with his kids, which you guys call the Bigs.
So when I first met Ryan and first met the kids, I was fascinated with how he parented them from the get-go. I was noticing things right away that were a stark contrast from the helicopter parent that has mm-hmm. grown, you know, to be so common these days. You know, we were actually in a corn maze, and he was just kind of letting them a much longer leash than I was comfortable with. And I thought, gosh, of all places, I mean, a maze is meant to get lost in, and he seems cool as a cucumber. And, you know, afterwards they're making their own purchases in the store. And, you know, soon I'm learning that these kids know how to shoot bow and arrow. They all know how to ride a motorcycle. And I'm thinking, these kids are more adventurous and well-rounded than even I am. And so over time, I realized that he was implementing some of these CIA skills into the way that he parented. And I was skeptical at first because, you know, as an analyst, I'm more of a data-driven person. I see the world a little bit more black and white, whereas Ryan lives in the gray. And, you know, I thought, shouldn't we just let kids be kids? These are serious topics. Mm-hmm. Do we need to be teaching them about these things? And Ryan helped me see that when we do it in a fun way that emphasizes adventure and we view these as building blocks over time, you know, none of these skills are done in a vacuum. They're built up over time as we're building our relationship of trust and building up our kids' confidence. And when you view it like that, it becomes less intimidating and more empowering. And what I found as someone who experienced postpartum anxiety after my son was born, who's almost 5, I needed these principles to help me parent from a place of strength instead of fear.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this concept of talking to kids about danger. And there is the difference between scaring kids and empowering them. There are boys and girls in the mix of kids here. Do you teach them how to evade danger differently?
We don't, you know, and we actually, it goes girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, which Ryan's very proud of. So few people could accomplish such a pattern. But no, we teach them the same. And, you know, it's impressive to see the girls doing the same things as their brothers because mm-hmm. it's uncommon. I will tell you, you know, I share a story in the book about one of our daughters and, you know, blowing everyone away in PE class when they did an archery unit. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the kids had never done it, but in particularly the girls. She, you know, shot it out of the park, bullseye after bullseye. And, you know, we were just so proud of her because that's just another skill. You know, is it because, you know, spies use bow and arrow? Of course not. But we use archery as one of the many skills that makes our kids well-rounded. And that's one more opportunity for them to shine, to create, you know, connections with people. It's a conversation starter. And then, of course, you know, we can also talk about it in terms of survival as well.
Right. In a zombie apocalypse or a long time loss of electricity, I'm the first one out. Nobody cares where an Oxford comma goes. Like, this is not helping survival at all. I'm going to go find your kids.
You need all of these skills, from the writing down to the more physical skills. We want our kids to be prepared for anything that life throws at them. And these are real life skills to make them safe and successful. And no spy training is needed. You know, anyone can use them.
Walk us through what's in the kids' adventure bags.
In the adventure bag, we start out when they're 2 or 3 years old and they've got Band-Aids, a glow stick, you know, a headlamp, different things like that, a little compass, a little whistle. And we involve them as we sit down and every single item as they put it in. And my son Ari calls it his adventure, or, well, we call it the adventure bag, and he sometimes also calls it the Indiana Jones bag. And he takes it with him on every hike. And if his sister gets a boo-boo, he is the first one to get out his adventure bag to put the Band-Aid on her. And sometimes I'm like, why just, even me, if I get some sort of scrape, I'm like, well, I'm just going to get my own Band-Aid. You know, you have child-sized Band-Aids. You know, I don't need a Star Wars one. Let mommy go get a Band-Aid. But he insists, and it becomes very fun for him because he's invested and he's a part of it from the get-go. And of course, those adventure bags evolve as our kids get older and they turn into what we call go bags. And that's something that CIA officers get whenever they arrive at stations, you know, an emergency bag with everything they need. And then, and we include those in our cars as our kids get older. Each car that we drive has one in it, and we account for how many people could be riding in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get, you know, we have more sophisticated things in those, but we start when the kids are young.
If they learn it from a young age and associate it maybe even with being fun, the importance of staying calm in a situation like that.
Exactly. The importance of staying calm, but also the importance of not freezing. And so by having them do things like this, but then also we do a lot of role playing with our kids, and, you know, we have them visualize things out. You know, we talk about spotting and avoiding danger. And as part of that, we talk to them about visualizing their escape route, because, you know, oftentimes when an emergency happens, people can be frozen. And Ryan shares a story of his CIA training in the book about a time where he was frozen in his training, where, you know, they were being shot at with paintballs by the instructors, and how people froze, you know, in the exercise. And so that's something that we want our kids to avoid doing. And so the more we train them and we teach them this concept of getting off the X, moving away from danger, the X can be anything, a person, a place, a thing or environment, but listening to that gut and moving away from it and having opportunities to visualize these things, role play, walk through them, you know, including emergency scenarios, it becomes less scary and it becomes natural. You know, our kids, when our teenagers leave the house, we can say to them, hey, remember to get off the X. And they know what that means, because that concept was introduced to them at a young age and it was built up over time in an organic, not intimidating way.
Yeah, and you have a story about, I think it was both daughters, but it might have been a daughter and a friend, thinking that they were being followed and didn't have cell phones, and how to safely go into somewhere, one, well-lit and public, and then make these calls and get off that X, because that situation can escalate very, very quickly.
They did the exact right thing, because we have to understand that these are kids. Mm-hmm. And they're going to make mistakes, right? And the best case scenario would have been had they brought their cell phone with them, right? But even in that situation, cell phones don't always work. Technology can fail. And so it's also about emphasizing this idea with our kids to know how to improvise. So, okay, you don't have your cell phone. What do you do in this scenario? Yes, find a gas station, go in there, ask to use the phone, you know, find somewhere to stand so that you're not seen, so that you're, you know, to get away from these people who you think are following you. You don't keep walking home to get there quickly because you're scared. You know, you don't want people to know where you are. You don't stay on the dark lit path. You listen to that gut and you improvise and think on your feet. And so that's also this theme of thinking critically that is woven throughout the book that we really want our kids to get used to and do more and more of.
So the book, License to Parent, has already been optioned for TV. Do you get any creative control in the series?
Yes, so it's been optioned by Imagine Entertainment, which is Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's production company, and we love the team. We're absolutely ecstatic about it, and we are very involved in the project. And so we feel grateful for that. And we're excited for more to come on that soon.
Well, yeah, because we established at the beginning, Hollywood usually doesn't get the spy thing right. So can you give us any teasers about how they're going to tackle having this cool spy thing that we've all grown up thinking James Bond is like, and then you know, the much more, and well, actually, there's a lot of staying calm and writing.
We're hoping for something that will be authentic to our family and to our experience at CIA. And what we really love about the team at Imagine is that they do put such a special effort towards the true stories that they're depicting and the people's lives. And they really make it a point to make sure that the people are involved in their story and that they're telling it in an authentic way. And so that's one of the reasons why we went with that team. And we're just so excited to see what they do with it.
Who do you hope plays you and Ryan?
Oh my gosh, that's a good question. I do know who I hope plays Ryan, but now I can't even think of his name. He was in Age of Adeline. Michael Huseman, or Mikhail, I'm not sure how to say his name. Actually, I'd love for Blake Lively to play me.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of the cast. That's a very good-looking couple, you and Ryan. Christina, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed our discussion.
That was Christina Hillsburg, author of the book License to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. That conversation first aired in July 2021.
The Fargo-Moorhead Choral Artists conclude the 2023-2024 season with Holding the Light, a concert including repertoire around the focus of light in our world. Saturday, April 20th and Sunday, April 21st at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead. Ticket information can be found on Eventbrite or through fmchoralartists.org.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Gladys Hawk, enrolled member of the Standing Rock Nation, as she talks about language and culture loss.
I think it would be important for them to know that it was taken away from us in the late 1800s by the federal government. And so they established schools and had our ancestors taken away from their families to get them assimilated into the society, the new society, as they say. So that we could become farmers, for example, or we could become teachers maybe, or bakers, or cooks, or whatever. And so that concept came on down until it reached the point where now women are, you know, just as equal to men in positions of work or employment. But anyway, that part of our culture has changed through the years. In 1995, they brought back our language through the Act of Congress. And then, before that, in 1978, they told us that we could practice our religion. That was this law that became, you know, and it's been part of our culture forever until it was taken from us. And then there's a whole span of two generations, I would say, where we couldn't do anything, and that's where we lost a lot of cultural stuff, our practicing, our ways. But now it's different. It's coming back.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
The Bismarck Band and Civic Chorus presents a night of beautiful music and heartfelt performances, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Bel Mayhus Auditorium. The concert I Will Remember You includes performances by Jubilate of the Central Dakota Children's Choir, scholarship competition winner Benjamin Harrington, and vocal group Avora. Tickets are available online at bismanchorus.com or at the door.
Thanks for listening to this parenting edition of Main Street. You can catch all of our shows on our archive page by going to prairiepublic.org.